But I wanted to change gears this morning, and it'll probably be changing gears for the next few Sundays. And what I wanted to do was actually start talking about the Scripture of Great Wisdom. And I think one of the first things to do is those of you who have Scripture books, those of you who don't, if you go to the calendar link on our website for today, it'll give you links to the scriptures we actually sung this morning. But if you open up to page one in our scripture books, you can see that the Scripture of Great Wisdom is basically not much more than a page long. Very, very short. And yet it's basically the most important scripture in Buddhism. The Scripture of Great Wisdom is sung literally in almost every single Buddhist temple the world over. It's that significant. Tibetan Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, everywhere. And we've got a nice book on the shelf back there, written by a Japanese monk on the Scripture of Great Wisdom. We have a book over here written by the Dalai Lama on the Scripture of Great Wisdom. So the Scripture of Great Wisdom is sung in, most Buddhist temples, most Buddhist monasteries every single day. And as you've noticed, when you come to morning service, the scriptures we sing during morning service, we almost always sing the Scripture of Great Wisdom. The few times that we don't sing it are when we're doing something like the renewal vows ceremony or some other festival ceremony that has kind of its own specific kind of scriptures associated with it. So that was kind of to mention that, give you the context for how highly regarded the Scripture of Great Wisdom is in Buddhism in general. What I'm going to be drawing on, I'm going to be reading various excerpts from, see if I can hold it up to the camera here. It's called the Shambhala Dictionary of Buddhism and Zen. They kind of call it a dictionary. To me, it's more an encyclopedia. But it has really, really good entries for pretty much anything you can come up with that's related to Buddhism. So the Scripture of Great Wisdom, we have the word wisdom in there, which in Sanskrit is prajna. That's probably close to the right pronunciation of it. So the Sanskrit for the Scripture of Great Wisdom is the Prajnaparamita Sutra. A sutra is basically what we've translated as a scripture. So it's the Prajnaparamita Sutra or the Maha Prajnaparamita Sutra. Maha is Sanskrit for great. So Mahaprajna is great wisdom. So the sutra, the scripture of great wisdom. Or as they mentioned it here in this entry, it's the great sutra of wisdom, the great sutra of the wisdom. And the literal translation is the great sutra of the wisdom that reaches to the other shore. And the other shore is, again, sort of a visual metaphor for reaching that which is sort of transcending or liberating us from ordinary daily reality. Now, what's interesting is the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra. It's one sutra of a series, a collection of about 40 sutras. There's sort of the Great Wisdom Sutra in 100,000 lines. They've got one that's, I think, like 8,000 lines. That would take us a little bit longer. It'd probably take us a whole week to do that one. So there are just lots of scriptures that were written in ancient India. Buddhism traveled from India to China, and in China, somewhere around the beginning of the Common Era, basically 500 years after the historical Buddha was living, they gathered up all of these different scriptures that had to do with teachings about wisdom, about prajna. And so you have this huge collection of 40 sutras, some really, really long. And those of you who are familiar with our practice, some of the other ones that are in this collection of 40, there's one called the Diamond Sutra. And we will someday talk about that one. And then you have the Heart Sutra, which is part of that. So what's interesting about the Heart Sutra, which is synonymous with the Scripture of Great Wisdom, it's called the Heart Sutra because it's considered to be the heart of that whole collection of wisdom sutras, of wisdom scriptures. So the heart that they're talking about is going to be, you know, it's sort of like the heart, the center of the core, the essence of all of these scriptures. We're going to be very shortly starting with the lines, the beginning lines in the Scripture of Great Wisdom, and there's the word heart in there, and it's used differently. So what I wanted to do was read the excerpt in here for prajna. So the Sanskrit translation of that is either consciousness or wisdom. And it's considered a central notion in the Mahayana school of Buddhism, which again, the Mahayana school went from India to Japan, China, Japan, and Korea. So Korean, Chinese, and Japanese Buddha are the Mahayana tradition. So prajna, wisdom, is referring to an immediately experienced intuitive wisdom that cannot be conveyed by concepts or in intellectual terms. And the definitive moment of prajna is insight into shunyata, which is loosely translated as emptiness. I'm going to kind of go over these things quicker, and then we're going to go through it kind of word by word. So the definitive moment of prajna is insight into shunyata, which is the true nature of reality. The realization of prajna is often equated with the attainment of enlightenment, and it's one of the essential marks of Buddhahood. Okay, so I think that gets us kind of in the right ballpark to start taking a look at the actual words in the Scripture of Great Wisdom. So it starts out with the first half of the sentence. First sentence is, when one with deepest wisdom of the heart that is beyond discriminative thought. And similarly to what I said in the dedication, the word wisdom, prajna, wisdom of the heart, deepest wisdom of the heart, is having that direct experience into the nature of reality. Like, okay, how does one have that direct experience, that intuitive experience into the true nature of reality? It's through practice of meditation in our tradition, which is being described here in shorthand, which is where they say that is beyond discriminative thought. It's also beyond emotion. It's also beyond sort of physicality or physical sensation. But that's just sort of understood to be in there already. You know, and realize that, as I've mentioned before, that we're all aware of what it's like to sense and feel our bodies, have physical sensations. We all know about emotions, the arising of those. And we all know about mental activity, thoughts, and so on. And there's kind of a progression there as we're growing up. were mostly physical beings as kids. And somewhere in later on in grade school or junior high school, the whole emotional realm starts arising in us. We start learning how to navigate emotions, work with emotions. And then, of course, kind of later on in earnest, we start kind of developing thinking and so on through schooling and so on, high school, college, etc. And oftentimes in our Western culture, we think that's kind of the pinnacle of being human, is that faculty of intellect and so on. And meditation says physical sensations arise, emotions arise, mental activity arises. Don't hold on to it. Don't push it away. Reverend Master Jiyu says very, very bluntly, she says, when we get to the point where we are no longer kind of caught up in and involved in the activity of the mind, only then will we start touching into and experiencing that deeper intuitive understanding of that fundamental aspect of reality. Now, what's really interesting here, we'll come back to those first two lines in just a second. So the third line in the scripture says, the Holy Lord, great Kanzeon Bosatsu. Kanzeon Bosatsu, Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara. A few weeks ago, we were in the ceremony hall and I was talking about Avalokiteshvara, Kanzeon, Kuan Yin, which is representing great compassion. Kanzeon Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of great compassion. We can see, we can understand Avalokiteshvara to be, as it were, kind of a manifestation, an expression of that compassion, that great compassion that permeates the universe. We can see Avalokiteshvara as a being who's expressing that compassion. And in the context of this scripture, it's being written that the Bodhisattva Kanzeon is in deepest meditation. He, she, this being, this Bodhisattva is in deepest meditation, i.e., thoughts arise, thoughts pass, they're just not getting distracted by them, they're aware of them, emotions, physical sensations. And in that deepest meditation, what is arising is the experiencing of that true nature of reality. So Kanzeon Bosatsu is actually directly experiencing the true nature of reality. So that's what those three sentences are saying, setting the stage. There's a sort of a parallel understanding of that also, which is, as I mentioned when I was talking about Avalokiteshvara in the ceremony hall, it's representing that compassion, that great compassion that we all partake of also. It's there within us. When we express, when we act compassionately, we are exhibiting, we're expressing Avalokiteshvara, we're expressing Kanzeon Bosatsu. And what's really interesting here is that it's actually crucial, it's vital, it's deeply significant that this whole scripture is being, as it were, presented, described for us, talked about because of great compassion meditating very deeply. In Buddhism, our practice, our training always starts with compassion. And Reverend Master Jiyu would say that this was, you know, back in the late 60s and 70s, particularly at that time, but, you know, it continues to this day. And, you know, most people, when they come to Zen Buddhism, they're like, I want to know what the truth is. I want to experience that deeper reality. Of course, people would be just deeply fascinated. They'd get a hold of books and read about descriptions about what that ultimate reality was all about. And it doesn't work that way. That's basically you're missing two very vital steps before that. You know, sort of an equivalent phrase is like you're trying to storm heaven. You have to basically come at it from the point of view of compassion first. You have to come at it from the point of view of wishing to be present with reality as it is in your life right now. That's the beginning place. We have to learn how to be with it, i.e. learn how to accept what's there, the stuff we don't want to accept, the stuff we don't like, you know, which is the not pushing away aspect of meditation. So there's this very kind of beautiful sort of story or metaphor in Buddhism where it talks about we start with compassion. Compassion is the mother. And then it's kind of interesting because it all kind of mushes together a little bit. But as I was saying, it's more the Achalanata, you know, the shrine on the left-hand side is more the compassion in the sense that it's learning how to steadfastly, patiently be with things as they are as best we can. Be present with the situation as it is. Open up to that fully. And then what arises from that is what's expressed in the Avalokiteshvara shrine, which is actually what we do when we're fully present in a situation. What arises very naturally is what is good to do. And then we do that. And that is considered to be spiritual love. It's the activity of compassion, the expressing of compassion. So Avalokiteshvara, so compassion, this is how come it gets a little mushed together, but you have compassion is the mother, spiritual love is the father, and what they bring forth is wisdom, prajna. They bring forth the child of wisdom, manjushri. And so it's basically what this is showing us is this is the practice that we do over and over again. We meditate with what's there in our life at any time. That's the expression of compassion. That's the openness, acceptance of compassion. From that naturally arises the wish, the sense of what's good to do. We act on that. That's the expression of love. And in the process of doing that, those two things over and over again, what will arise is the deepest wisdom of the heart, is we will actually start directly experiencing that deeper level of reality, that more fundamental level of reality. So one way of kind of checking with ourselves is that if we are concerned about, if we don't feel that we have a sense of that an experience of that deeper reality, you know, if you're like, I don't understand what this deeper reality is, come back to seeing about how your meditation's going, how your acceptance is going, how you're not holding on and not pushing away is going. Check in to see how open and soft you are to any situation that arises in your life. And then also, you may be getting quite good at that, but also start checking in with, well, when things arise as good to do, when it arises that this is something that I have a sense should be done, are you doing that? Are you acting on that? And remember, one other way of describing this, Reverend Master Jiyu would talk about it quite a bit, and it goes back several hundred years to, I believe it's Great Master Keizan, who was in the late 1200s in Japan. They talk about the still small voice. When you are beyond discriminative thought, i.e. when you're meditating, the sense of what is to be done, it's very still and small and quiet, that little voice, so to speak, that little niggle, that little sense. It's really, really subtle. And oftentimes it'll just kind of come up. In my experience, it'll come up sort of like just this little mental little glimmer. And fairly quickly after that, it will be gone again. And it's like, okay, were you paying attention? Was I paying attention? You know, and again, just to bring it down to our everyday practical life, Nancy was here yesterday doing some work in the garden and was turning on some of the watering drip irrigation here and there. And before she left, she showed me where there were two leaks in the hoses, which I need to fix before next Saturday when she comes back again. And I looked at one, I had fixed one previously and it had started leaking again. And, you know, after the initial kind of grumble, my repair didn't work. I don't hold on, don't push it away, try to be open. Okay, it needs to be fixed again. It was just there. I was just open with it. Hey, that's meditation, that's compassion. And then just this little mental, I don't know if you want to call it thought, it was more like an image came up of how to fix it. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty straightforward. That'll work fine. Now, I'm not actually going to be doing the practice unless I actually do this. If I actually follow through on this little thing that came in my mind. You know, people say, you know, they talk about, oh, I have all these great ideas. Good. Right, and got to do it. Usually we tend to sort of err on one side or the other. We're really good at acting on things, but really bad at maybe being a little more still to see what's really going on in the situation a little more deeply. Or we're really good at being still and open and attentive and really tuned into what's going on. But then putting it from my point of view, then I chicken out when it comes time to actually do it, particularly in areas where it's like, I can remember as a novice monk, it would come up a number of times that I should say something in front of the whole community of monks. And I would get too nervous to do that. It's like, okay, we get what we need. We get shown what we need to work on. And it's that combination of the compassion and the spiritual love acting on that. When we do that, it's kind of a cycle. Our insight, our intuition, our understanding of that deeper reality just naturally grows. I'll stew on it a bit more, but I'm not sure I can even say it any better than that, because, you know, it's like it just works that way. And how do I know what I know? I don't know. I do. It's sort of just kind of shown to you or revealed to you. And it has nothing with me being more physically active or more emotional or more intellectual or anything of that sort. In fact, it's kind of, you could say it's kind of the opposite. It's letting go of my connection with my attachment to my involvement in any of those things. They're still there. I'm aware of those things there, the emotions, the thoughts, my grumbling about, oh, it didn't work. My first fixing of the leak didn't work. It's all there, but I'm giving it space. So the very next line, actually the very next word on the top of the next page. So great compassion, sitting in deepest meditation, experiencing true reality. Next word is because of that, Kanzan knew something. Kanzan experiences something, which is what I was talking around just a little while ago. It's like when you do this, understanding arises that you didn't experience before. You know something. Now, I was doing the practice well by just being still with the leaky hose. So the process that unfolded with that was good. That was meditation going on there. What's being said in the scripture of great wisdom is that they're talking about the deepest wisdom of the heart. I think I could correctly say that the insight, the intuition that came up as to how to fix it, well, that's coming from the wisdom of the heart. But it might not be the very, very deepest that could be coming up, put it that way. And so basically what Kanzan knows, she then describes and talks about for the rest of the scripture. And she's going to present it in very succinct, very almost formulaic way of describing this deepest wisdom. And so, in essence, what's being talked about here is, and this is going to take quite a bit of unpacking. To begin with, I have the question to throw out for all of us is, how would you describe being a human being? And what Buddhism has tried to do over the ages is describe what it is to be a human being. And it's really, really significant and important that what I mean by describing being a human being is what is your own personal experience of being a human being. So it's, to use sort of more modern terminology, we describe it from the first person being a human being. We're describing it subjectively, what it's like to be me. That's what Buddhism is concerned about. It's from your own experience of being you, how to take that, how to work with that, how to practice with that, how to train with that. So what's interesting in presenting it that way is that all of the teachings in Buddhism from the time of the historical Buddha with the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the kind of development of that as it went into different cultures and, as the years went by, all of it is from the orientation of all of the teachings are from the point of view of what it's like personally being a human being in the world. So it's very much not from the point of view of what we would call a scientific perspective, which is more kind of third person objective way of describing. It's like, oh, a human being. Oh, you go into a doctor's office and you get your blood pressure checked and your weight checked and et cetera, et cetera. Those aren't what you would subjectively experience as being yourself necessarily. So keep that in mind as we go through this. And I guess what's interesting too is to bring up from your own experience of being a person, do you think it would be right to contend or say, would you describe it as the problem of being a human being? Or maybe the challenge of being a human being or the difficulty of being a human being? And Buddhism is contending that probably based on a very large sample pool of lots of human beings over the centuries, that yeah, when it comes right down to it, there is kind of at the nub of it, there's a problem in being a human being. And we are trying to address that in Buddhism. So historically, Buddhism has, there have been many sort of models, if you will. There have been many, a number of formulations to try to describe the total experiential reality of being a person. It's trying to describe the whole spectrum of things that can occur that we experience as being a person. And those are all lumped into the heading of what are called the skandhas, which again is a Sanskrit word. So with deepest wisdom of the heart, Kanzan knew, and then immediately she knew something about the skandhas. In other words, she's knowing something about the experience, the subjective experience, the first person experience of being a person. And we're being very fancy here and using what I sort of regard as sort of religious language, which of course you put to music and so on. So you talk about the skandhas, five skandhas. But historically, there have been other models where there have been four skandhas. There have also been some models where there are six skandhas. But we have five that we're going to talk about. Think of it as, you've all seen rainbows. You know, you've seen light being broken up into different colors through a prism. It's kind of arbitrary as to what you're going to label the colors of the rainbow, right? They're sort of red, but when's it kind of turning into orange? You know, you call that orangey red or reddy orange, or when's it kind of transition to yellow? You can go, oh, there's red and then there's yellow. Well, what about orange? So there's the whole spectrum of visible light, the colors of the rainbow. You know, you look at a rainbow, it has all of the colors, but the categories that you use, they're kind of arbitrary where you draw the lines, right? But the important thing is we're trying to encompass the whole spectrum of color, the whole spectrum of what it is to be a human being. In ancient India, and also in ancient Indian Buddhism, they absolutely loved coming up with lists of things and trying to describe things with incredible detail and precision. And there are some scriptures that go on for pages and pages and pages of trying to fine-tune the description of all of these experiences. We're not going to do that. But if you want references, I have them. And sometimes it can be very interesting reading just to kind of see the depth of observation and precision that Buddhist practitioners went to, you know, back even thousands of years. They were very sincere about what they were doing. They were very, very precise, and they rival, to my mind, sort of the precision that, you know, science uses nowadays. Okay, I think what I'll do is just over the next few minutes is talk about the five skandhas kind of in broad terms. And then we'll end it for today. And you'll see that we've basically not even gotten through really the first actual sentence of the Scripture of Great Wisdom, because there is so much in it. So the word skanda, it means a group or sometimes an aggregate. So it's kind of like a category of something. So going back to the color spectrum, you could talk about there's that group there that I'm going to call red. on one edge of it, it's kind of really dark red. On another edge of it, it's kind of orangey red. But we'll call that the red skanda, so to speak, the red group. We've got yellows and greens and indigo and violet and purple. Blue. Yes, I forgot blue. So the very first skanda is the group, the aggregate that we call form. Form means matter, physical solid matter, or it can be liquidy matter, like water. So you get, in ancient Buddhism, you have what are called the four elements of matter. And matter has to do with things that you can physically experience. This is what's interesting, is it has to do with your body and what your body can physically sense. Okay, so that's the skanda of form. We can sense things that are physical, solid. We can sense things that are liquidy. We can also sense things that are warm or cold. So some sort of level of heat in them. We can also sense things physically that are moving. The other skandhas, they have much, much longer lists than those four things. Rest assured, we're not going to go into it in that much detail. But again, so we have this skanda. The first skanda has to do with our physicality. All of the things that we sense physically as a body and our body interacting with things. Now, what's really interesting about having a physical body is that our physical body has sense organs. The first sense organ that I was talking about was our physical sensations. And we also have sense of taste, sense of smell, hearing, and seeing. And we also have, in Buddhism, the sense organ of the mind. We can sense thoughts. And the word thoughts I put in quotes because it has to do with anything going on mentally. So like a memory is in the grouping of a thought. Thinking about what you're going to do this afternoon, planning, etc., that's a thought in shorthand. So we have six sense organs in our physical bodies, according to Buddhism. So that's the first skanda. And I'm just going to briefly list the other four, and then we'll call that good for today. So we'll set the stage for next Sunday. Okay, so the first one is you have form or corporeality, having to do with having a body. The second one is sensation. And third one is perception. And you have mental formations and consciousness. And we'll briefly talk about all of those next time. So again, just to kind of come back to what this is trying to do, is it's trying to describe anything that you can experience as a human being. It'll fit in one of these five categories. And then based on that experiencing, then what we'll do is take that deeper and show that it's actually pointing to something. It's something that Kanzan knows through direct experience about that subjective experiencing we have as a human being. There's something very, very deeply significant about that. Well, and why don't I just state it? So the five skandhas, i.e. our subjective experiencing that we have as a human being, it says in our self nature, it's void, unstained, and pure. Void, unstained, and pure is a way of translating the word shunyata. And void, unstained, and pure is actually saying that what we're actually experiencing as a human being, at its deepest level is ultimate reality. And the way of describing ultimate reality is shunyata, which is void, unstained, and pure. And obviously that all needs getting unpacked, which we'll do next time. I know in a sense this was getting a little bit technical, a little bit detail-oriented, not quite like some of the other talks I do, but once you have this under your belt, you're like, oh yeah, Scripture Great Wisdom is talking about how you realize ultimate reality. And what's interesting is that in describing the spectrum of our human experience and really seeing what's going on there, it'll actually quite naturally show us why we meditate the way we do and how we need to kind of carry on with our daily practice. And by doing that over and over and over again, we will experience what's actually directly being talked about in the Scripture of Great Wisdom.